Jason Chaffetz is, well, a polarizing figure. There's no two ways about it. As the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Chaffetz was a constant thorn in the side of the Obama administration and rankled many Democrats with his investigations into the administration's handling of the Benghazi attack and later Hillary Clinton's private email server. For Republicans, though, Chaffetz's work proved pivotal in ultimately building a case against Hillary even before she became the 2016 Democratic nominee for president. Anyone charged with holding power accountable will ultimately be accused of bias against the target of their inquiries. So was Chaffetz truly interested in holding power accountable as his position demanded, or was he just a partisan attack dog? The election of a Republican president promised to provide some answers to this question, but Chaffetz chose to step down just a few months after the Trump administration took office. So how could we know? Well, why not ask him? Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and joining us today is former Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who's currently a Fall 2017 Fellow at the Kennedy School's Institute of Politics. We began the conversation by talking about some of the issues that have come up in his weekly study groups with Harvard students, principally concerning the intersection of policy and technology. Congressman, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, before we got started, you were telling me about some of the things you've been speaking with the students and your study groups, and technology was a big piece of this. And of course, we know that technology has changed everything about our lives. I'm curious about how are we too stuck in the past on how we approach technology and in terms of our regulation and also how we think about government's involvement with it.
Well, technology is great. It will improve the effectiveness and efficiency of your life. There's a lot of cool things you can do with sharing photos and videos and talking to somebody on a video chat. I mean, it's amazing, right? You look at your phone, you can talk to and see the other person on the other part of the world. But it also creates an unknown number of problems and challenges. And I worry about this intersection between, well, how much liberty are we willing to give up in the name of security? What is law enforcement doing or not doing? What are private companies doing? So think about everything from autonomous vehicles to facial recognition, drone technology. You know, what are your rights? If you have a drone hovering over your backyard other than using a shotgun, what are you going to do to take that down? What happens when an autonomous vehicle is hacked? What about your car that you may be using now? I mean, basically, they're rolling computers. Mm-hmm. You're going to call your highway patrol? You're going to call, I mean, who do you call?
Right.
You have Google and Amazon and others that want to deliver goods and services, or goods, I should say, right to your door or at your beach. They have the technology, but the FAA can't really do it yet. Mm-hmm. And then that poses a bigger question. Who controls the airspace in your backyard? Is that right. The FAA? Is that the state? Is it your city? Is it your county?
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of interesting public policy challenges.
The courts have ruled on many of these things based on established law, something like a Dropbox account. Traditionally, if we had a file on our computer, then there would need to be probable cause. You need to have a warrant to actually access that. But if I have a file on Google servers or Dropbox's servers, that doesn't require that same level of scrutiny for law enforcement to actually access it. Do you think we need to rethink what the Fourth Amendment itself is and how it's applied to our current digital world?
Absolutely. There was a case called the Jones case, and I'm not an attorney. I just kind of played one in Congress. I say that jokingly, but the Jones case, where the Supreme Court ruled 9-0, this is where law enforcement had followed, by putting a GPS device, followed a car for 28 days, and sure enough, the person committed a crime. He said, that's a violation of my Fourth Amendment. The court concurred. Mm-hmm. All sorts of interesting problems with technology. Who owns it? Where it is? There's a Microsoft case. If you go and use cloud computing, if that cloud is actually located in a country outside of the United States, then what are they subject to the laws of the United States? Do they have to comply with what law enforcement's asking them to do? again, a whole set of new problems and challenges, from the most basic thing about can you track somebody's geolocation to who owns the data to patent issues. It's a whole new realm. And you have a Congress that, by and large, 90%+ of them, they have no idea how it works. And it's a real problem, because you got policymakers who don't use, consume, or understand the technology. And oftentimes they're trying to provide surgery on these types of things, and there's not a geek, nerd, or surgeon in the room. And and that's the worry, is the overreaction. It is one of the great segments of our economy, but there do need to be some rules of the road, and there do need to, I think, be an awareness of what's happening here. More than 14 of our states, when you go to get your driver's license, you're populating the FBI database. So you're a suspicionless American. Now you're in the FBI database for what? For getting a driver's license? Where else do we do that? We don't do that in other situations.
It also, most recently, there was the Equifax data breach, which was a huge exposure of really almost the entire adult population of the United States. Enormous. And right now, we as consumers, nobody chooses to use the credit reporting bureaus. They just do their thing. There are no limits. Is there space there for, you know, some kind of government federal regulation to enforce some form of security or some level of, you know, if you're going to be collecting information about people, you have to actually keep it safe. Should there be some accountability there?
There does need to be accountability, and there will be an untold number of lawsuits regarding that. But I don't fundamentally trust my federal government. I mean, think about, there are $1.4 trillion in student loans being administered by the Department of Education. We did a hearing about how the lack of security. They have more than 100 million Social Security numbers, and when you fill out an application to get a higher ed student loan, you put your credit union, your banking information, your mutual funds. I mean, you basically open up your kimono and show them everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they're securing $1.4 trillion worth of stuff. They have no dual authentication. They did not have encryption, was something that they argued they didn't have to have. Are you kidding me? We had the data breach at the Office of Personnel Management. We had, through the Department of Interior, is how they got in there to do these types of things. There's a consequence to everything going digital. Mm-hmm. And whether it's public or private, there's still a vulnerability. And I just, again, I want people to go in eyes wide open, because a lot of that data, a lot of your own personal information is out there and being used in ways that most people would be flabbergasted by. Just be absolutely just like, you got to be kidding, that all that information's out there on me. What if I want it back? What if I change my mind? You know, part of the reason I'm here at Harvard is to not only probe, but also try to stimulate the thought to say, what should this look like? Because we're blazing new trails in forests that we've never been to, and we're exploring things. But just because we can doesn't mean we should. And I worry that we're taking it a little bit too far. And again, I think one of the big seminal questions for the American public, for the students that are at Harvard, is how much liberty are we going to give up in the name of security? I don't know where the right balance is. We all want to be safe and secure, but I don't trust my federal government to handle all that information all the time.
I will say that I personally don't trust Equifax either at this point. But
understood. Yes.
One of the ways that this has impacted us most obviously in the current discourse is the use of the Russian use of our social networks to try and fiddle with our elections, whether it be the 3,000 ads that Facebook just turned over to, I believe it was your former committee, or you know, using Google ads, Twitter accounts, all of these kinds of things. This is something that's really, really hard to combat because it is free speech, ostensibly. Anybody can open up a Twitter account and say anything. But at the same time, never has it been more integral to our society that these open forms of communication have been able to influence people without any kind of attribution or any kind of, you never saw the Boston Globe or the Washington Post running, Russian propaganda in the past.
Oh, I probably.
Well, okay, maybe. At least it was under a byline.
Yeah, there's some degree of accountability, and you can trace it back. And look, this can be a subject of an untold number of hearings. Particularly, the bigger the company, the Facebooks and the Twitters of the world, providing that. The participation in an election, there is a First Amendment right, but that First Amendment right doesn't extend to people in Russia or pick any other country you want. That is for Americans to participate in. And I think there are people offended on both sides of the aisle that, even though this number seems to be very small, I mean, you look at the size of Twitter and Facebook and the number of ads and impressions, this seems to be very small. Nevertheless, it's fundamentally wrong. We better get ready for the next election. I do worry about a couple things. I think a lot of states move to electronic voting, and I think they're really scratching their head saying, I mean, come on, wasn't it obvious at the beginning? I mean, what could go wrong if we have machines that would... Good old-fashioned paper ballots are probably going to be the way to go. We also, one of the things the Oversight Committee was looking at is the census. I have really big concerns about the census because they were trying to move to an app-oriented, internet-based response. That is fraught with all kinds of problems, and I really do worry about it. And if you're not working on it in 2017, you're not going to be ready by the time 2020 gets here. And I think it'll be one of the big questions. So there are untold number of different ways that we can create chaos, but everything doesn't need to be oriented towards the internet and technology because it can be manipulated. It's mm-hmm. proven itself out right now.
Certainly. So I wanted to talk about your time in this House Oversight Committee. When you were first elected, you gunned for the House Oversight Committee, which was unusual because it's not one of the big committees. It's not one of the high profile ones. And that decision panned out for you. It took you, three terms to become chairman of that committee?
Yeah.
That was based a lot on a strategy memo that you put together for your leadership. That talked about elevating the committee, talked about using social media more, about using it as a tool for investigating the current administration at the time, which was the Obama administration. Was that always your did you think when I get elected, that's what I want to do? Or was that something that it just seemed like an opportunity ripe for the taking?
So as I decided to, run for Congress, I had been the chief of staff to Governor John Huntsman. And then I got to see the delegation and I thought, you know what? I think I can run and I think I can beat that person. And I did. Which then leads you to thinking about the different committees. Well, there are 18 authorizing committees in the House. And I ended up with four principles that I really wanted to drive. Fiscal discipline, limited government, accountability, and a strong national defense. That's how I got elected, on those principles. But when I got to Congress, I figured out really quickly that not as many people were paying attention to accountability. And that if you get accountability right, then a lot of these other things actually fall into line. But there was this one committee founded in 1814 that Abraham Lincoln actually served on when he was in Congress, a different name, but same committee. And I really became attracted to it. I saw that most of my colleagues were not paying attention to it. And I drove for it and was fortunate to get there. Now I left. But it was an amazing experience. We got to do a lot of good. And I just believe at its core that the American people, we're different. We're different than every other country on the face of the planet. We are open, we are transparent, and we are self-critical. Mm-hmm. And that principle should not sway from side to side depending on who's in power. Mm-hmm. If it's your party in power, there shouldn't be a different set of rules than when your party's not in power.
Right.
That's not who we are. And so to carry on that history and carry that torch for a small time was a great honor. We did a lot of good.
A lot of the things that you investigate, I mean, the most high profile being, of course, Benghazi, Hillary's emails, they speak to something of more of a kind of a mismanagement type of thing where folks in public positions aren't doing their jobs appropriately or effectively. When the Trump administration came in, I read some interviews where you were less interested in the things where potentially some of the administration officials were profiting off of their positions. I think the time that pops into my mind is when Kellyanne Conway was promoting Ivanka's clothing line. So, and there was also the Kushners and et cetera. Do you think that the House Oversight Committee's role should be more on things where administration officials are essentially not doing their jobs appropriately, rather than more the traditional definition of corruption where, you know, yeah, they're profiting?
I probably disagree with the original part of your premise here, because I personally was the very first person to come out when Kellyanne Conway said, she claims jokingly, but was on Fox and Friends and was promoting Ivanka's line. I was the first one to come out and say, wrong, wrong, wrong. You can't do that. I sent a letter. I highlighted it. I went on national television to say as much. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very consistent with what I had done during the Obama administration. I was elected the same time as President Obama. I would have done the same if, you know, somebody else in his administration was promoting something that their family was doing. So I think it was very consistent. What I found, what was disingenuous from a lot of my Democratic colleagues, they were crying foul and yelling, screaming, pulling out their hair before Donald Trump was even sworn into office. You know, I was very aggressive in going after the actions of Hillary Clinton, but she was in office some good 4 years before I really even got revved up. And I did so, particularly in you mentioned Benghazi. Well, I was the chairman of the Subcommittee on National Security. So I did a preservation letter. I sought documents. We eventually did subpoena on those documents. It was later revealed through an inspector general that she was hiding classified information in a non-secure setting. That set off this whole email investigation. I didn't just start with that. I responded to an inspector general who came up with mm-hmm. this. So
what did you think of the news about Jared Kushner using his own personal email account?
Hey, look, I went out very quickly on national television and said I felt like it was tone deaf. I had actually sent a letter with a live
tone deaf is a little bit less than the
well, but you know, we're talking about less than 100 emails here. And what I did say, what I did do when I was in Congress, again, it's different when I'm not in Congress, but when I was in Congress, Elijah Cummings, my ranking member, and I actually sent to the White House a letter, essentially a warning, but asking for a list of any of the top administration officials that were using private email to conduct official business. And they responded and said none. Mm-hmm. And now I hope they do get held accountable. It is wrong that you come to find out at least one news source, I don't know how reliable it is reporting that there were six officials.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I put a marker down pretty early to say, you can't do this. It is tone deaf if they haven't seen what we highlighted in the Obama administration for the last several years. For them to come in and start using private email, even if it's a few, I mean, if somebody sent you something to your private email, there's a way to respond and say, I can't talk about this on private email. Please use this address and I'll continue the conversation.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see what those look at. And I think my old committee, Oversight and Government Reform, it may be the Intel Committee, others are going to be looking at that. I don't know what they unearth. I'm sure there's some innocent stuff in there, but if there's official government correspondence, the reason this is important is then it won't be part of the federal record. And under the Federal Records Act, you have to maintain that. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope a fair-minded, honest person would say, there are tens of thousands of Hillary Clinton emails that are still not part of that record, and how fundamentally wrong. And nobody was held accountable for this.
What now, is accountability for you? I mean, what does that mean? Not just in terms of investigating and finding out whether something happened, but the consequences of that.
As best I can tell, there were roughly 300 people that were touching classified material in a non-classified setting. I don't understand how they can still be employed by the federal government and maintain a security clearance. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are taught, they are educated about the serious nature of classified information. Some of it is so classified, by the way, that even I, as a committee chairman with a pretty high security clearance, I did not have a high enough security clearance. We're talking about a handful of people, the president, the vice president, you know, and a couple others have this type of security clearance. And yet this is in a non-classified setting. People get killed for this information. Sources are revealed in these types of situations. So there's a severity that from the benign all the way up to somebody's going to lose their life.
Sure.
So accountability to me, how do you maintain your security clearance? Did they do anything to reprimand that person, re-educate that person? Maybe it was an innocent mistake. They were just copied on it. It wasn't their fault. But as best I can tell, the State Department now for coming up on almost 2 years has had an open investigation and it's still not closed. I don't understand that. And I think there should be a conclusion to this. Nobody lost their job. Nobody lost their security clearance. Nobody was demoted. How does that happen when you have such a mass of breach that was purposely done?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the FBI director would say, well, we didn't see intent. Come on. Hillary Clinton opened up her server on the exact same day her Senate confirmation started. I mean, that was the same day. Mm-hmm. So there's some of us that don't really believe Mr. Comey and don't agree with his conclusion. And not to relitigate that, but it wasn't just Hillary Clinton. There were hundreds of other people involved in this, including her own attorneys who were storing classified information in a non-secure setting. That's why the inspector general came in and said people should be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So far, the Department of Justice has not said they're going to prosecute it.
Mm-hmm. You made a great career out of going after Hillary Clinton. Between Benghazi and the email scandal, I mean, there's just no doubt about it. She was easy target for you.
She did all of that herself.
Well, of
she
course.
Has nothing to blame but herself. And of you know course. What?
Well,
when it did come out, she didn't fess up to it. She didn't come clean. Look, Benghazi was a terrible, terrible tragedy. There was a way to get through this in about 4 or 5 months' time, but they held withheld documents. They were not honest and candid about it. They would not tell the truth about it. And I think the country figured out that Hillary Clinton was lying about this.
Well, I guess that's my question is, there must have been a little part of you who was disappointed when Donald Trump won last November.
No, I mean, look, I had said many, many times, I'm so happy that Hillary Clinton is not the president of the United States because I found her to have this extraordinary negative quality in that I felt she could look in the eye of the camera and just lie, lie, lie. And I know that because the night of the attack in Benghazi, okay, it set aside the partisan side of wherever you are on this, the night of the attack, she calls the prime minister of Egypt and tells him the truth. There was a terrorist attack. She sends an email to her own daughter and says, there's been a terrorist attack. And then somehow between her and Susan Rice and Leon Panetta and the president and the vice president, they all, for a couple of weeks, tell the American public, well, it was this YouTube video that went awry. Well, guess what? I went to Libya. I went to Tripoli. I was the first member of Congress to go there just about 3 weeks after the attack. I was there all day visiting with the embassy personnel, other personnel. And guess what? Nobody ever brought up a video because it was a lie. They made it up. Nobody even mentioned it when I was there because it never happened. Certainly not in Libya.
Well, there were protests in Egypt, not in Libya. Not
correct.
But there was some confusion within the State Department. It was clear that there was confusion at the very least.
But that's not what we were told. If there was something going on, people were going over the walls in Egypt. If that happened to 12 hours prior, well, what did you do about it? I mean, she never talked about that. She never brought that up. She never said, we tightened security. We brought our ambassador back out. You can't even point to an email that goes out the door to be able to say, look, we told them there was trouble brewing. That there's not even a single email. There's not a phone call. And again, if you're having that kind of candor and you're talking about the problem, but here's what's wrong. They didn't say there was a fog. They didn't say that there was something wrong. What they said was, oh no, it was this YouTube. It was spontaneous. It was, that was a lie. That never, ever happened. And they stuck with it as long as they could. I believe, and it's a pure guess, my Jason Chaffetz gut, is there was a pending election. And they didn't want to say that there was a terrorist attack on a U.S. facility that close to an election.
With Hillary out of the picture and Donald Trump's administration coming in, I think your departure from the House, you know, it raised a lot of questions. A lot of people were wondering your the tried and true departure statement, spending more time with family. I totally understand that. Now you're here in Cambridge, which is a little far from Salt Lake. Is your family here, by the way?
They were. My wife was here all last week. And you get nice housing here. I got this 3-bedroom place with my family out here. And you know, this is just it is just a few weeks. Like I won't be here next week. I'll be off with my family doing some stuff in Montana and in Utah.
We heard a lot of guffawing when the announcement was made on Twitter, which naturally that happens. And I'm just curious for more perspective on why you chose to leave. You didn't serve out your full term.
Yeah.
You chose to leave early. Was it simply because it was more difficult to do it within the context of a fully Republican Congress and executive?
A couple of things were happening. The family situation over the last year and a half has really changed for the better in many ways. And my wife and I were blessed with 3 kids. 2 of those 3 ended up getting married, not only got married, but moved away. Mm-hmm. And faced with the reality that we're soon to be empty nesters really does change the equation. And I could spend the next 200 days over the next year and a half out there fundraising, being in Congress. My daughter was, less than 10 years old when I first got elected. When I decided to leave Congress, we went to Africa for 10 days, went to Hawaii for 10 days. I mean, we really got to spend some time as a family that I haven't been able to do over the last, because I've been in public service now for 13 years between either campaign manager, chief of staff to Governor Huntsman, candidate and member of Congress. It's just a whole different thing. And the second part of it, which is also very important, is I started to sour. I don't think it was healthy for me, and I don't think it was healthy for the body. I honestly believe you get in, serve, and then you get out. I was very frustrated that a lot of the investigations that we felt were very important, very critical, the Department of Justice and the Trump administration, I'm being very critical here, were no different than the Obama administration, in that I didn't feel like Lady Justice was actually following through with a blindfold. And so when you work hard for 5-6 years on some of these cases, and then the Department of Justice says, nah, we're just not going to do anything there. You just think, no, look, I'm not trying to be personal about, this isn't about Hillary Clinton. This isn't trying, it's people being held accountable, and it's the body standing up for itself. It was terribly frustrating. The promise of unified government, where I felt like a lot of the legislative agenda that we had would make it more of a glide path to actually achieve things, that wasn't becoming a reality too. I had this conversation several times with the speaker and talked about our legislative agenda, and he was pretty candid with me saying, it's not going to happen. So I'm thinking around thinking, okay, so if I can't get anything done, they're not going to be held accountable for the stuff that I'm doing, the oversight. What am I doing here? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a nice title. I get a nice business card and, but I thought, I just want to change gears.
And you keep the title.
Yeah, I get these people still call you congressman, and I still turn around. So
yeah.
But they call me Jason more frequently, and I like that too. So I got a better balance in my life. I got this great relationship with Fox News, and I really appreciate that. I can be on pretty much almost on a daily basis and still have a big voice, if you will, to talk to millions of people at a time. I have this wonderful relationship with Harvard, which is really just for a few weeks to kind of give back and share with some of the most impressive students in the country. And so I appreciate that relationship. The acting director here, Bill Delahunt, and I served in the Congress together, and he did a good job. He and along with Joe Kennedy and helping to talk me into this. And I'll do some other things. I'm working on writing a book and get a better balance in my life.
So what's next? Jason, 2020 governor of Utah.
I always kind of joke and say I'm a definite maybe. But, if I never run for public office again, my life will be complete. Maybe I've tried to keep that door open. I don't want to close it unnecessarily. But I also stepped away from it. And I didn't step away from it early as a precursor or a lily pad to jump somewhere else. I'm being honest about this. Washington, D.C. is all consuming. It is a bit of a cesspool. And you get in there, you give it everything you've got, and then get out of there. Maybe someday I put my hat in the ring to run for something else, but maybe not. I don't know. I can't see that far out.
All right. Well, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, he's a fall 2017 fellow at the Institute of Politics. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm Matt Cadwallader. That's at Matt Cad on Twitter. My co-producers are Natalie Montaner, Sarah Abrams, and Becky Wickel. Have something to tell us about this or any other episode? Let us know on Twitter at PolicyCast or via email at policycast@hks.harvard.edu. And visit us at hkspolicycast.org. See you next week.